Thomas Reed with us as we talk about his family's case, including him, a close encounter of the fourth kind. Okay, welcome back to Coast, Thomas Reed with us. Thomas, so as a young boy, you plop back into the car from this right. abduction case. What does your family say, or were they taken too?
Well, we all remember different moments from that encounter there out of the station wagon. I remember hearing voices and calling and screaming, and I assume it was my mother. I'd like to think it was my mother. My brother remembers being with my mother. We all have different recollection from that same evening. And when we were all found or came to in the vehicle, the station wagon, my mother was now in the passenger seat, and she had earlier been driving. My brother was in the back seat on the same side where he was before this happened. And he was kind of curled up, like the fetal position, I guess, kind of laying on the seat. And my grandmother was about three car lengths in front of our vehicle in the middle of the road. And I've mentioned in the past that she looked like she was kind of walking aimlessly because it didn't look like she knew where she was going, and had gotten so far ahead of the car that she started to walk into this little store, like a little late night. It had bikes and strollers and whatever.
Yeah.
And she had actually got into this store. She walked up. She got tangled up behind some bikes and strollers and baby carriages and everything else back there. And I was the only one that was really conscious, I guess, for lack of a better word. No one else was speaking or talking or moving. And I just got out and was running nana and had gone into this building with her. And it was a clerk there. She was trying to talk with him. And I think he was wondering why she got, how she got tangled up like that. And so I was grabbing her hand, and the two of us started to leave. And as she was going out, she broke down, and I guess it really hit her at that point. She had been, you know, she was pushing a baby stroller a little bit, and someone had asked me, "Well, do you think there's a reference there? Because she was a woman, maybe something happened." And I don't want to speculate, but she was pushing a little baby carriage around, and she had it in the grip of her hand, and maybe there's something to it, maybe there isn't. But we got back to the car, and my mother was now in the driver's seat, and we had decided to just get the hell out of there. And about a week or two later, I was in my bedroom, and my mother had come in to give me a kiss goodnight. She used to check on us twice, because at this point, my mother wasn't married. My father to be was still around. But had visiting. He was from New York City, and he used to come up a lot. But my mother wasn't actually married at that point, as a stepfather. And so she came in to give me a kiss goodnight the second time. And I, for whatever reason, to give you an idea, I used to be very, couldn't sleep well. This really started to really eat at me. And I had lunged forward, and I had a fork from the dinner table with me. And I actually caught my mother in the part of the eye and the forehead with a fork.
Oh, my God.
And I think at that point, my mother just said, "Look, you know, this is enough already." And so she would go on to work. She would she ran that restaurant, and she would get a lot of heat from the locals. You know, "Nancy, if you want to see something out of this world, we'll show you something out of this world." You know how people can be.
Sure.
Kind of rude and unnecessary. And then, of course, you had your locals that were in support of her, too, though. You know, that wasn't like, it was like a mix. But if you ever talk to anyone else on the radio from Sheffield, Massachusetts, it's like the Sedona of New England.
Yeah, they all know about this. At what point did you take a polygraph test?
I took that in 2010. Now, I'm glad you asked that, because we had been talking about how this affected us, this magnetic field that we felt, or at least we believed it was a magnetic field. When my brother had his encounter, which was much later, his car, he was driving back. This is what a lot of the shows have focused on, his vehicle, because that actually had physical evidence to it. That was, you know, the equipment that they had later on, they didn't have in the 60s. His car got hit. He was in Brownsburg, Indiana, and he was coming back to his house after a trip with a friend of his, Norm, was with him. Just dropped him off, heading back, and following this orange ball of light. And the next thing he knows, he's off the side of the road. But he had blood coming out of his nose. His vehicle had several thousand dollars worth of damage to it, which he had service records for it. He had marks on his chest, marks behind his right ear. I've got one on my arm from when I was a child. We don't know how I got that either. And perfectly round scoot marks. Some people say it's relevant. You know, I think it is too, actually. And we're all Rh negative, believe it or not. That came up in the testing that we did. But anyway, the vehicle had a magnetic field around the back of it that would spin a compass. It would pin it, basically. Debbie Cobble, who the book Intruders was written about by Bud Hopkins, actually came out with this funded Star Team Bigelow backing thing, which I don't really know the particulars in it. I just know it was right after they got their money and these people all came out. And she recorded it on camera. I've actually got pictures and video of the compass spinning. There were Geiger counter readings. It had magnetic fields around it. The way the email came to me was that they were radioactive hot spots.
Uh-huh.
Is exactly how they worded it on the back of the vehicle. So whatever hit this vehicle, if my brother was driving, appears to have hit the back of it. And so he went off the road. He was out for about an hour and a half. He doesn't really, that's about what he thinks or he can has concluded with his watches and time and where he left. He left the movie. He knows about what time he left the movie. And so that is really what fueled our case. That's kind of what has really got the attention, because there was actual physical trace evidence of that. Now, to answer your question that I'm kind of getting back to, is that at that point, Officer Steve White got involved in it. Even Chase Klutzke, who you might know, she got involved in it. She was part of that Star Team thing. And local authorities came out, but they wouldn't take a police report because there wasn't a crime. So my brother just made a police statement. And then you had a lot of local attention on it. We got on Fox News. You know, they want to know what happened and that sort of thing. But there were law enforcement involved in that aspect of it. Steve White was a detective, 30 years. He came down, spoke to my brother, spoke to me, interviewed us all, looked at all the evidence. And then, like any detective, you know, it's a lot to swallow. You know, I mean, he would finally word it in his statement that it was an encounter with an unknown powerful force. And to me, that's a lot for an officer to say to begin with. But so he asked me would I agree to take a polygraph test? And sure I would. And so,
yeah, that's the only way to settle it, right?
Right. So I went down to the polygraph center here and sat down with a police officer and Jim Morris, and strapped me up. And I don't know how anyone passes these things to begin with, but they were rot. You know, they had me wrapped up with straps around my chest and, you know, my heartbeat and perspiration. And my God, it was nothing short of a horror flick. And I just, okay. And they asked me, they had me in there for about an hour, just asking me everything and anything that they felt was pertinent. And then they started asking the questions on the monitor and taking the actual readings. And at the end of the day, they just basically said, did you lie to us about anything? Did you lie about this? Were you purposely trying to mislead me? Were you, you know, I've got a copy of the polygraph test. I think I sent it to you.
Mm-hmm.
But I passed with a 99.1%, which apparently is extremely high.
Which is amazing. So let me ask you this. How did one, and then we'll take some calls here for you, Thomas, how did this case get to the United Nations?
Well, here you go. And I mentioned Jug Inn Resort earlier, and I'll try to speed this up a little bit for you. But this is really what I think speaks very loudly for this field and why I think certain cases deserve a lot more attention than they get. My father ran for office in the 80s, Howard Reed. He went to law school, became a college professor, doctorate in law, and he wanted to run for mayor. And in his campaigns, he ran across Robert Bletchman. And I'm sure that name rings a bell with you also.
Yeah.
He used to work with J. Allen Hynek. So what happened here, and this just is, in some respects, it was just luck if we were to go forward with this story and get it out. This is, a lot of this just happened to fall into place. My father ran into Robert at a mixer, and they're both Democrats. They were both very public figures, you know, No Child Left Behind. You know, they were kind of, you know, support the groups here and locally and that kind of thing, you know, Boy Scouts, whatever. And over, I guess, a couple of drinks, I think it was at the Hampton Inn, mentioned that that Robert was interested in the Hudson River Valley case. I think that's what he was looking at first. And my father says, well, you know, we had quite an experience when we were younger. And so Robert inquired about it and come to find out that my condo was only about a mile and a half down the road from his law firm. So my dad gave me a buzz, you know, go see this man. I think you'll like him. He's a nice guy. And he was. I liked Robert a lot. And I would stop into his office quite often, and I sat in his office more times than I can imagine, looking out his big window there, and he had pictures of these crafts that were taken underwater by police officers at the Hudson River Valley, and or the Hudson River Valley cases. And so we got into our case. And unknowing to me, he knew J. Allen Hynek. And so when he called up and started making some inquiries about the case in Sheffield is when he came across the Jugend case that put these crafts or these witnesses that saw the craft just 7 miles from our home. So that really gave him or really fueled his interest. And so he really looked into our case and spoke with some of these people. I know that Tammy Blackwell, who was at the city hall, has been spoken to a couple of times. They talked to people at her old restaurant, you know, the whole thing. I don't want to take up too much of your time, but there was so much going on there. So about maybe 6 months later, I stop in his office and we've talked a little bit more. It's spoken to my father. My father actually had run for office, was backed by Senator Christopher Dodd. Dodd had come out for dinner with my family and, you know, Governor O'Neill, and my father was in office. He did two terms, selectman, you know, what have you. And so with the support and the backing and with his political aspirations, he's now a political or a pillar figure in the community. Robert wanted to be able to reference a family that, you know, had that kind of a standing, I think. And so that's how our case ended up going to or getting involved with Bleckman. So we get a call. Hey, guys, it's Robert. You know, we're going to be putting together a symposium. I'd like to be able to mention your case. You know, please just don't make it a front runner,
yeah,
right? Because you never know what you're going to do down the road. But Cash Landerman was involved in that. You know, we have information here from the Greece Ministry of Defense. You've got the Pentagon records. My father has files like you can't believe. But that came back afterwards, really. But so that's how our case ended up getting mentioned on October 2nd, 1992, at the United Nations Symposium. I think it was 10 days before SETI launched their new microwavable technology. And this was in conjunction with Mohammed Ramadan, I think, who was the head of the Parapsychology Society. I think some of this was reviewed in a library. Some of it, I think Linda Morton Howe was there.
Sure. Yeah, sure.
Was there. I mean, you know about this. And our case was just happened to be in the back side of it. But what was really bizarre, and this is turns my stomach, is that my father, you know, we kept our mouth shut because he had his run for office. He had aspirations to go further. And we feel that he lost his life keeping his word to us, because in 2006, he started to getting ready to retire. You know, he was also teaching at night. He was a college professor and starting to, you know, wind down and had some money, and he was doing very well for himself. And mentioned to me, he came to Boynton Beach, Florida, and said, you know, I think it's time that because they had a boat down there in Hutchinson Island. And, you know, I think it's time that we, you know, wrote what we, you know, keep our word to you and get this book out. And so he still knew Robert, and I don't know if he was still working in conjunction with Robert, but he had a lot of notes, a lot of files. If I showed you what I had, maybe you've got a lot of it anyway, but if I ever run into you, I'll bring it and show it to you. I got bins of this stuff. Everything from Sign to Project Blue Book to stuff from Truman, you name it. And so I don't really know what he had or what he was going to write about. It may not have had anything to do with our case. But my father, after announcing the fact that he had a book project and he was going to be, you know, announcing some things he thought would shake the community up, and I think the book was going to be called something Round Table at Cornerstone. And he goes into work, a perfectly healthy man, 56 years old. That's young. And
very young.
And sits at his desk, and he gets violently sick, and his head fell to the table, I understand, and So then they rushed him to the hospital, and they lost him. And
sorry to hear
that. The hospital gave him every antibiotic they could. They couldn't figure out what was wrong with him. And at first, the New York Times actually ran something on my father stating that they thought he had Legionnaire's disease or something, but it doesn't kill you like that.
No.
You get Ponta fever, you know, antibiotics, it clears it up, he's healthy. So because he was friends with the mayor of Bridgeport, the CDC was called in, and they found some new ceiling tiles or something in his office, and they ripped out his air conditioning unit, and they found out that there was a deadly virus that was placed in his air conditioning unit.
That was put
from what
there?
I understand.
Jeez.
Yeah, it looks like that could be accessed from the outside. It looked like a tube that had been broken, and they were all we know is that they were, as far as they looked, they resembled red luminous sticks. Long, you know, as far as a virus would look, you put it under a microscope, they look like red luminous sticks.
They got him.
Ever heard?
Jeez.
And it killed him. And the odd thing was that he did lose his life under questionable circumstances
mm-hmm.
because he did. He was.
They never caught them,
murdered.
Though, did they?
And what's really bizarre about that is he was killed on the same day, October 2nd, that our case went before the United Nations. And again, our case was not a front runner. It was only something mentioned on the back burner. But I think what happened was my father had gotten his hands on a lot of information that most people wouldn't have. And because he was a public figure, and because he could call up Fox News, and because he could get a front page story in Hartford Courant if he wanted to, or make a call to the Boston Globe, that he could get whatever he wanted, front page news, without too much effort.
Somebody wanted him out of the way, Tom.
Well, let me tell you this. Bleckman died a year after my father, and the doctor, Michael Buckner, the doctor who looked at my brother, looked at me, looked at my father, looked at pretty much everybody in our family, that the records, he wrote a letter on September 12th. He was killed November 15th.
Do you think they're trying to get rid of everybody?
Now here's the, and to be honest and fair and conservative here, I can't say that maybe there was a coincidence. Maybe the doctor.
There are no coincidences. Things happen for a reason. I'm convinced.
Well, you know, if I look at that, I say to myself, in 2005, when my father came down to visit me in Boynton Beach, it's because I was run over by a tractor trailer truck that kept going, and they found the truck 4 miles down the road. And I got hit off of, you know, Florida. I got hit on Boca on my way to work. I was a little Infinity off the exit, same way I always go to work. A tractor-trailer truck came barreling down the highway, smashed into my car, and just kept going. And there were construction workers there on the side of the road that saw it all. I was almost left for dead, which is why Miami Models basically was on hold, because I couldn't...
Was it an assassination attempt on you?
You know, I can't say, but here's how you look at it. And I understand where you're going with it.
Hold on for one second. Just hold on. We're going to hit this break. We're going to come back. I need you to answer that, and then we'll wrap it up with phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. On our next Coast to Coast program, it'll be that Friday night into Saturday morning, open lines, plus a little fun thrown in for you. When we come back in a moment, we're going to wrap up our story with Thomas Reed, and then we'll take your phone calls for him on Coast to Coast AM. So you get hit by a tractor trailer in... I think it's an assassination attempt, Thomas. What do you think?
Well, if you look at it, if you look at it in a way that I'm kind of agree with you on this, but then again, I try to put it out there, let everyone else make their own mm-hmm. assessment of everything. But okay, I was run over by a tractor trailer truck on December 19th in Boca Raton, Florida, and almost killed. My father was killed a little over 6 months later. Robert Bleckman went. I can't speak for exactly how. I haven't spoken to his wife, but I know that I believe it was supposedly some form of bizarre cancer. And then, of course, the doctor, who I understand was asphyxiated 8 weeks after going public with medical records.
Jeez.
And so I look at that and I say, okay, what do these people have in common? Well, it's this bizarre case. And when you have something extraordinary, and then you have extraordinary events that take place, I've also had an FBI agent come to my house. I've also had a guy sit me down on the front steps of my home on June 6th and ask if I travel internationally. if I am savvy with computers. He sat there. He knew more about me than I did.
What do they want?
And he gave me a card. I've got his name here. He came from Colorado. I live in Tennessee now. He came all the way from Colorado. It was Key Point Government Solutions, and they were asking me. Then they flipped the card over and made me swear to these privacy acts of 1978. So I really can't get into detail about what he questioned me about. But these are not things that happen to just everyday people. And so with that, I also would like to mention to your listeners now that the CDC has closed that building to this day that my father was killed in. And we're going 6 or 7 years later.
Was it a big building?
Yeah, it was a school.
So it's shut down. You can't get into it.
No, you cannot. It's been shut down and condemned to this day.
Remnants of the virus still out there?
I wouldn't know. They won't let in. Last time we drove by it, there was a couple of vehicles out there. I've got a picture of what they said on it. I can send it to you just for your own personal.
Yeah, I'd like to see.
Put the phone number out there. But and on top of that, now the mayor of Bridgeport has put a holiday in my father's honor. So now October 6th is a locally recognized holiday or proclamation in my father's honor. And now if you go to the city green, there's a bench dedicated to my father and the bench.
Interesting, I'm glad, but strange.
Well, it's kind of like if you take out somebody who's a political figure, how do you make the community feel peace with it, right?
Name a street after him or something.
There you go. You know, my father was a terrific man, and he was basically paying forward the years that we backed him, the years that we said, we're not going to ruin your campaign, we're not going to talk about it in school. We moved out of state. We started fresh. And when the day was right, you said you would mention it. Well, after I got hit by the tractor-trailer truck and he came down to Boynton Beach, Florida, that's when he said maybe now's the time. Maybe because he thought I almost died and he wanted to do it before
right.
something happened.
Right, and maybe he knew something. Let's take some calls here for you, Thomas. Then I want to wrap up with you and get your best guess on what you think happened to you and your family. Let's go to Brooklyn in Las Vegas, Nevada, first-time caller. Hi, Brooklyn. Go ahead.
Yes, hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
So basically, I just wanted to know what significance, if any, does the blood type Rh negative have to do with this type of phenomenon? And I'm going to take my answer off the air.
I have heard that this could be tied into one of the reasons why they go after people specifically. Did you have that kind of blood type?
I have O negative. My son has A negative. My brother has A negative. My ex-wife was AB negative.
All
my
negative.
Father was O negative, and my mother was O negative. And it's strange that we have 9 members of our family that are Rh negative. Now, my opinion, I really believe this. I believe that the O negative or part of that O negative or the antigens or what have you is a platform for the original race of human. I don't believe 90% of all blood type you can trace back to, you know, the chimp and what have you. But no, I think the Rh negative factor is the original bloodline of man, and I think that's why it's so valuable. I also think that there is my brother had puncture wounds over his a gland that produces the T cells for the immune system. I also think there's an interest in that as well.
That is strange, isn't it?
Yes.
Extremely. What do you think was the reason this was happening to you and your family? Why you folks?
Well, at first, my mother really didn't know what happened in Maine. You know, I think she was just as confused as anybody. But after, I'd say, 69, when this was, there was nowhere else to turn but to face it. I think that we're looking at something that was being something genetic. I believe that there was something being extracted. I also believe that there's very possibly something being exchanged. I mean, if you look at the scoring of my son, he was in the superior range. He's 6 foot something tall. I'm 5'6". My ex-wife was 5'2". My son's almost 6 foot one, actually. Star quarterback. Smartest attack was in the superior class. He was doing 13th. Grade 13 math in fourth and fifth grade. He beat an unbeaten chess pro in elementary school. He's got a keen sight, insight for things. I can't say for sure this has anything to do with it, as I don't have anything to reference it against. But my son is off the charts, and that came from somewhere. And then, you know, we did have a very unique and strange event happen to us on multiple occasions. And yes, sure, Pratt & Whitney was an hour and a half away. Command Aerospace wasn't that far away. There were Nike missile sites supposedly in the area. You had Electric Boat that wasn't far in Groton, maybe an hour and a half. So there was a lot of area there that might have been of interest. But our hill in Sheffield, Mass., and where this happened, was very rural, yet access to an awful lot of military-type installations that might have been of interest, and maybe that just put them in our backyard. And because of that, we were a victim of some testing. And maybe because we did have the Rh negative factor, we fell victim to whatever it was that they were mining for or had an interest in.
Maybe so. Let's go next to Teresa in Albuquerque, New Mexico. Hi, Teresa. Go ahead.
Hi. I just had a couple of questions.
Sure.
Okay, this happened in 1969. And what state was it in?
Sheffield, Massachusetts.
Oh, okay. So you said this happened to you in your childhood.
Right.
Did you ever encounter anything in your adult life?
My brother talks about what happened to him in Brownsburg, Indiana in 2009, which we found quite interesting because it was 40 years later. And there's a lot of speculation on why that happened also. When this happened with my brother back in the 60s, and we were basically 4 and 6 years old. And my son has had some things that have been noted, these strange nosebleeds, his ability to kind of have an insight on some things, and what I just mentioned earlier, that he seems to be off the charts.
So do you think it's genetic?
I have to believe that it's something other than just natural development. But my point is this: when my brother had this happen with him on the 30th, which was just on Covering Aliens, is that his youngest son, Wyatt, was turning 5. So there's been an awful lot of, well, could it be that nothing has happened because you hadn't had children, and now that your son or your brother had a son that was the same age that you were when this happened with you, could it be that there's an interest in, you know, taking a look if whether or not he has the same traits that you do? And maybe that's just looking into it too much, or is it something we should just ignore, or is it something that we need to take a look at? I mean, we've had such a crazy experience with this. I'm kind of open to anything right now, but there are patterns that are starting to show themselves. My mother was 15. She was with her girlfriend, and they both had children, boys. And then, you know, my brother and I had these experiences, and then we had children, boys, our entire family, Rh negative, Rh negative, Rh negative. Something's, I don't think it's coincidence.
Did you write a book about this?
No, actually, I tried, but I've been out of college a long time. But if I had someone who wanted to help me with it, sure, I'd be more than happy to. I've got certainly enough information here. I just haven't been able to really piece it all together and make it happen.
You're just a witness. And someone who went through something very, very strange in your life. So, you know, as you look at and you look back at what happened to you, what happened to your family, any idea, did they ever communicate with you? Did they ever say, this is where we're from, this is what we want? Did that ever happen, Tom?
The only thing that I remember of communication, if any, was when I was standing in a hallway, and I was at the bridge of a doorway that went into a larger area. I was very upset because I was looking for Matthew, and I think having Matthew with me made me feel more comfortable. I wasn't alone, and so I was worried about, you know, being alone. I started to come out of this, whatever it was, and I started to like want to run and didn't know where to go. And there was these images that popped up on this front of this screen. It would look like it was a willow tree with a body of water, and it took my mind off things for a minute. And then there was a touch on my shoulder. I remember like a touch on the shoulder, and it was like it made me feel like I was important, or we were there for someone or something was ill. I got that impression. I can't say that it was. It's a feeling that I got. I don't know how I got it. It could have been telepathically. But I asked myself if I could, why images, if they could communicate with me, or was it just a combination of things? Was it the image came up to get my attention off what I was doing and then get me to calm down and then send me a symbolic message along with something telepathically? But at that point, I became calm. And I don't remember words, but I know that I left feeling that we were ill or they were ill, and one of the other was in need of something. And now I look back and I see that my son is very advanced, and that's in black and white. He's been tested at the Miami Children's Hospital. He's got a test here from, you know, Kaufman tests. He's been tested at the Knoxville Hypnosis Center. He's been tested at his schools. He's off the charts. Why is that? He's in the 127th percentile. That's off the charts.
That's pretty good.
Yep, and that's not just third party. That is comes directly from his school records. Now, I'm proud of him, but it's not like he does his homework. You know, so there's something going on.
All right, let's go to Abel in Oklahoma City. Abel, go ahead.
George, thanks for taking my call. Real quick, just want to say I'm a big fan of the show. My first time able to call the show.
Thank you.
And hats off to you, George, the way you handle the format. Amazing. Great job.
Thank you so much.
Mr. Reed, my question for you. I heard you earlier in the broadcast mention a couple of different type of beings, I guess you would call them, that you had seen or encountered. How many different type of beings have you encountered and seen? And if you could, maybe I also heard you mention human, something that was very human-like. Could you explain that a little bit more in detail? What was human about it? What wasn't? And I'll take my question off the air. Thank you.
Okay.
Oh, sure. Okay. The very first thing that my brother and I saw together was what looked like, and remember, we were children, but I'll do my very best to describe this to you, almost looked like a glowing figure. When we were young, we referenced them, and we had a lot of notes, and it looked like a ghost. That's what we used to say, and, you know, we had these ghostly-like figures that we seemed to have followed into this craft. But once on board, they didn't look like that anymore. They weren't. And if you could take a small oriental person, pale, put him in a white jumpsuit and give him some large eyes and bald head it was an overbite. Didn't have the pointy chin thing. That I do know. It was like an overbite. And then just a 2-watt illumination. That's kind of what it looked like. It was just, maybe it was something around him to keep away bugs. I don't know, but it definitely illuminated. And then my brother said to me once, he says, well, if we were not a right state, maybe our eyes could have been watery, and that's why it looked that way. But it's a good point, but no, they were glowing in some way. And then on board, they just looked more like thin, a lot of human characteristics, but very thin, very frail. At one point, they were wearing what almost looked like a bluish attire, and another time it was more white. And the eyes had like lenses. They were not like the huge almond ones. They actually looked more like they were rounder towards the nostril and then wrapped backward. So they were rounder near where the nose, the bridge of the nose was, and it sort of tapered off on each side. And I feel I remember this, seeing something like look orangey underneath that lens, which originally is what I thought might have been a biological eye underneath that, and why I said I think they're lenses. As far as the more horrific looking insect, if you will, it was about, I'm going to say 4.5 feet to 5 feet tall. The legs were almost perfectly like pencils that kind of stick straight, and it kind of would lower and higher itself. And it had like a teardrop body with multiple lumps to it. It looked very gray, mushroomy gray, and the head looked almost goldish, or like a bronze gold. And I'd say something else about this too. The craft itself had a lot of what looked like bronze or brown on it. You know, a lot of people reference a shiny chrome and stuff. It didn't. There was a lot of brown and maybe like a bronze actually. And there were symbols, and I've written those down. I actually gave the symbols to Bud Hopkins in 1994, and got a copy of them here. And on these tables next to these beans that looked kind of insect-like and so on, there were some type of symbols on these lower tables. And that's another thing. The tables were not very high. They were very low. Being that I was 9 years old and I could see the top of them, they could not have been that tall. But the figure itself, I don't remember seeing any teeth. I remember, you know, this football-shaped head with these eyes, again, that looked very much like the head of a red ant.
Kind of ugly, and, but again, if you were from his planet, he probably thought he was pretty good-looking.
Right, and there were two. But I do remember that they had what looked like human hands.
Thomas, it's an incredible story. Look, we've got to run. Let's keep in touch. There's a reason they've been approaching you, and maybe one day you'll find out, and that Thomas Reed's case, of course, was highlighted in Uncovering Aliens with Mike Bearer. That is on the Sci channel, the Science channel. Just an amazing, amazing story. For Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudisor, Timothy Banal, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Knapp, John B. Wells, and Art Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everybody.